First, after another string of mass shootings in Ohio, Texas, and California, a familiar question has come up. Were there warning signs that, if handled right, could have prevented the violence? Jillian Peterson is a psychologist and co-founder of the Violence Project, a nonpartisan group that researches ways to reduce violence in society. She and her colleagues have studied every mass shooting since the mid-1960s, as well as would-be mass shooters who didn't go through with their plans. Jillian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, on the face of it, Jillian, it seems like it would be impossible to profile mass shooters as we think of it. They're fortunately few and far between in some cases, and we'd get more false positives than negatives. But you've been making the case that that doesn't mean we should give up on trying to figure out who might be the next mass shooter. Why is that?
Yeah, we certainly don't want to create a profile, and we've studied about 160 of these incidents where four or more people died, and certainly no one clear profile comes forward. We can't give you a checklist and say, here's who's going to be the next mass shooter. But we do see commonalities in these stories and commonalities in the data that give us kind of a pathway forward in terms of prevention.
You say there are four main things that keep coming up when it comes to mass shooters. One of them, childhood trauma. Can you tell us what you found there?
Yeah, so almost every single one of the mass shooters that we looked at had something happen in early childhood, and this ranged from a parent committing suicide, physical abuse, sexual abuse, severe neglect, but some significant childhood trauma. Now, of course, the vast, vast majority of people who experience childhood trauma would never do something like this, but that seems to be the starting point where this happens, especially for young boys.
Then there's something you call an identifiable crisis. What kind of things could that be?
So you see this kind of build over time, starting with trauma, the development of some mental health concerns, typically a lonely, disconnected in school. They get to a point where something happens that's kind of the final straw. For school shooters, this tends to be something that happens at the school. For workplace shooters, that tends to be losing their job, getting fired or suspended. For other people who do public shootings, it tends to be like the loss of a relationship. But something kind of pushes them over the edge, and then 80% of the time you see them become actively suicidal.
Let's stop at those two for a moment and talk about what we can do with that information. Obviously, as you say, not everyone with childhood trauma will become a mass shooter. Not everyone who has this kind of crisis will become a mass shooter. But are there things we can do as a society to help people who face those two things and give them a different script, a different path?
I think there are. And one hopeful thing is that if we do these things, it's not just mass violence prevention. This is violence prevention in general. It's self-harm prevention, that a lot of these strategies would have multiple outcomes, hopefully one of them being reducing mass violence, but they would be positive in a number of ways. So one thing is looking at social-emotional learning in schools, things like resiliency training, coping skills, empathy, having school-based mental health care and school social workers and school counselors starting at young ages. The second thing is helping teachers, parents, anyone really, help identify when students or young people are in crisis. What does that look like? What are the behavioral signs? How do you step in? What do you say? How do you de-escalate? How do you talk about suicide? And then knowing where to report if you're concerned about someone so that they can get help and intervention that they need.
Speaking of school shootings in particular, I've read some of what you've written and watched some videos, and you talk about the need to have everyone in a school setting ready to deal with that student who raises the red flag. In what it might be the counselor, it might be a principal or teacher. You talk about one case, I think, where it was the janitor.
Yeah, we are seeing that the right person to kind of intervene with the student in crisis is the person that they feel the most comfortable with. And I guess one hopeful thing that we found in talking to people who maybe planned on doing a school shooting and didn't do it is that it's kind of one person stepping in and making a connection that can really get them through that moment. It doesn't actually take that much. I think we have a tendency to push these problems either to law enforcement or into the counselor's office. And we're not saying that, you know, the shop teacher or the receptionist needs to do full-on therapy, but be able to say, hey, you don't seem like you're okay. What's going on? That's something that we're trying to carve out spaces for people to have those conversations, to feel comfortable with those skills.
Talking to Jillian Peterson, psychologist and co-founder of the Violence Project, looking at ways to hopefully prevent potential mass shooters and other perpetrators of violence, for that matter, from taking that kind of action, steering them in another direction. Now, we're talking about four main things that you found mass shooters have in common. We mentioned childhood trauma and this identifiable crisis. Now, another one is that mass shooters often think about and study and research other mass shooters.
Yeah, so we see that you have childhood trauma, you get to this identifiable crisis, you are feeling actively suicidal, then people oftentimes take to the internet to find validation for how they're feeling. People focus on a certain grievance that they have. So whether that's the grievances with the school or with their workplace or with a certain group of people, with women, with a certain race, you see that anger and people searching out for people to validate those ideas. And individuals get radicalized pretty quickly within these groups. You also see men who do this studying other perpetrators and feeling connections with other people who have done this and looking for that script of how it's done.
What can the media do, we in the media do, to maybe make to break that chain, I guess, to make it so that that information about the mass shooters isn't so front and center?
Yeah, I think it's both the media who tells the stories and then us who consume these stories to be more aware of what we're consuming. So when these incidents happen, the goal is for them to go viral. The goal is to get notoriety and deaths that you didn't have in life. And so we see them having higher body counts and doing things like distributing manifestos or filming them on GoPros. The goal is for these to be sort of watched and seen. And so when someone writes a manifesto and it gets spread across the internet and we all read it, that was the goal. So that makes now this a script for other people who want their ideas out there. So in order to stop that, I think one thing that media has done that's been really helpful is stop naming mass shooters and showing their faces. I think we can all not spread that violent content, not spread things like manifestos. I would love to see 24/7 coverage of the victims in these cases and the heroes in these cases rather than the perpetrators.
And then the fourth thing in common is the access to firearms. That's the last commonality you found. But in some cases, perpetrators obtain weapons differently. Can you talk about what you found there?
Yeah, so for school shooters, for example, we see that 80% of them are taking weapons from other people. The most common is their parents, but also grandparents, friends, other family members. So 80% of the time they're taking other people's weapons. So the implications there for policy are really around safe storage and education around safe storage. For workplace shooters, we see that they tend to use handguns that they legally own. So these tend to be people who would pass background checks. And then for other types of shooters, the more public retail or restaurant shooters, you tend to see people who buy weapons illegally and more of the assault rifles. So if you use the data to look at how people get their weapons, it kind of leads you to different trajectories for prevention.
Right. Let's talk about some of those. First of all, that thing, the perpetrator of a school shooting, how to make sure they don't have access to their, say, parents' gun.
Right. So if there is concern around certain students, that would be educating parents about how to safely store their weapons. I mean, say gun storage lockers can cost $200. So also kind of a public health campaign to make sure people have access to safely store weapons would be important.
And then the we hear a lot about red flag laws. That's been something people have talked about a lot in the wake of these last few shootings. Do you see those as a potentially effective way to allow police, I guess, to take guns away from people who present a current danger?
Yeah, red flag laws is something that our data would really support because so many of the individuals are known to be actively in crisis and suicidal before this happens. Red flag laws would give police the ability to go in and remove firearms from these individuals for a certain period of time, enough time to get someone through that crisis point. And so if we know that someone is a danger of self to others, red flag laws just create a step for prevention.
And then finally, the third way for those more public shootings you mentioned, illegally obtained firearms. What can we do that we're not doing now?
You know, there's a number of proposals out there, things like cracking down on people who are selling them illegally on illegal gun distributors, looking at gun shows and private sales, and also passing more widely spread universal background checks.
Now, you talk also about school shootings in particular. These last few have been in the summer, not school-related, but the school season is coming and kids will do Code Red drills or whatever the local version is, where they prepare for a potential mass shooting. You have concerns about how we're doing that and the impact it has. Why do you worry about those?
I do, and it's for three reasons. So our data has shown that 91% of school shooters are current or former students of the school. And I think that fact really changes how you think about these lockdown drills, because 91% of the time, the perpetrators are kids who are running through the drills. So they know the school's exact planned response. And in some cases, that's been used to actually increase casualties rather than decrease them. The second concern is around kind of our third point, that these are socially contagious, that people find this script. And I have concern as a psychologist that when we start running kids through these drills at a very young age over and over and over again, are we normalizing this behavior? And are we handing young students this script for violence and saying this is something that happens? And then the third piece of it is just data that's emerging that those drills are traumatizing, not for everyone, but especially for vulnerable students, and they build an anxiety, and we're seeing more mental health problems in this younger generation than any generation before them.
Well, Jillian, reading your work, you seem to be hopeful in some ways that if we pay attention to the data and how past shootings have happened or not happened in some cases, we can prevent them. Can you talk about the work you do at the Violence Project along those lines?
Yeah, I am hopeful that we can do this. So we provide training and information to workplaces, churches, schools, and it's a really different approach than how to lock down, run, hide, fight, and increase security. Instead, the approach is, how do you create connections? How do you build relationships? How do you make sure every person is known? How do you look for behavioral signs of a crisis? How do you check in with someone about suicidal thoughts? And having a care team approach. So if someone is in trouble, you know what the resources are, what the protocol is. In 80% of cases, there's leakage ahead of time. People are posting things online, telling other people, but no one knows what to do with that information. So we really need actual systems in place to help people report that information.
In our last minute or so, politicians, policymakers, candidates are talking about this issue right now. What do you want them to hear and take seriously?
I want them to look at the data. And I think the biggest thing we have to do is embrace how complex this is. These are complex stories, and you can't pull out any one thing and say, this is it. This is the reason. It's all of it. It is childhood trauma, and it is, you know, violence, and it is hate groups, and it is suicidality, and it is guns. It's all of it together. And so in order to move forward, we're going to have to tackle this in complex ways.
Do you worry that we pay very close attention to these issues immediately after a horrific shooting, and then it fades until the next one?
Yes. I actually think the right time to work on this is when we're not in the immediate aftermath. The immediate aftermath, we're all scared, we're all sad, we're all angry. And the right time to be pushing forward is when this all fades and we can really have evidence-based conversations.
Jillian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Jillian Peterson. She's a psychologist and co-founder of The Violence Project. That's a nonpartisan group that researches ways to reduce violence in society. She was with us today in particular to talk about a particular kind of violence, mass shooting, in the wake of three high-profile mass shootings. What kind of things can be done in schools and in society to hopefully prevent would-be attackers from perpetrating these kind of incidents? You can find out more at the Violence Project website.